On November the 8th, 1983, the life of Carroll James Booker came to an end. He was 43 years old, one of New Orleans' most colourful and talented characters from the world of jazz and rhythm and blues, had become unconscious after having taken a deadly dose of low-grade cocaine. He was driven to Charity Hospital in his hometown of New Orleans and left in the emergency waiting room in a wheelchair, where he sat undiscovered until he was finally checked on and found to be dead. His short and remarkable life was made up of a chaotic tangle of extremes, from the devastation of family upheaval, a tragic accident, drugs and prison, to a record career that began at 14, working with musicians from jazz, rhythm and blues and soul, such as Little Richard, Bobby Bland, Junior Parker, Lloyd Price, Wilson Pickett, B.B. King, King Curtis, Aretha Franklin and Dr. John. His contrasting and individualistic style also attracted him to musicians beyond and into other genres of music, resulting in him recording with big names such as Ringo Starr, Maria Muldaur and the Doobie Brothers. Yet despite the genius quality of his piano playing, his rhapsodic improvisations and his unique ability as one of the finest of New Orleans' rich legacy of piano players, Booker's turbulent and unpredictable lifestyle denied him the recognition of greatness experienced by those that he worked alongside. Despite experiencing tantalising minor breaks, it wasn't until the mid-70s that things began to finally look up for Booker. During this time, he visited Europe, where he was received by appreciative and captivated audiences. His performance at the Boogie Woogie and Ragtime Piano Contest in Zurich, Switzerland, recorded in 1976 and released as New Orleans Piano Wizard Live, was a triumph for Booker, honoured with the Grand Prix de Disque de Jazz Award as Best Live Album in 1977. He followed that up with more European shows in 1978, including the illustrious Montreux International Jazz Festival. By 1980, Booker had returned from Europe. His health was in rapid decline, with increasingly tortuous mental nightmares closing in on him and worsening physical health brought on by a life of heavy drug addiction. But it was only a couple of years earlier that Booker had seen a brief glimpse of the recognition that he so richly deserved. There were many appearances in front of ecstatic and appreciative audiences, both in the US and in Europe. In 1977, Manchester jazz and blues musician, enthusiast and collector Dave Lunt brought James Booker to the North of England city, where an enthusiastic audience experienced the magnificence of this unique musician. The performance was captured by Dave and has now been released on the Document label titled James Booker, Manchester 77. We asked Dave to tell us what led him to promote James Booker's only North of England gig and to put into context the time, the place and an evening of music from one of New Orleans' most outstanding artists.
I must point out it was a doldrum time for the blues, this. Alexis Corner, for example, hadn't played in this country for many years. He was playing in Europe, and he found that there was no interest in this country at all at that time. It was the craziest idea in the world that Norman and I had to form an out-and-out blues band at that time. With sufficient fortitude, we managed to push ourselves through to some extent. The band was reasonably successful at that point, so we were doing concerts all over the place. I had worked with Johnny Mars, for example, in Europe, in East Germany. I'm sure that we'd toured with B.B. King by then, but we were doing okay as a blues. It was punk rock, that was the current fashion, so we were totally against the grain. But we did get some help, you know, people like Tony Wilson did see that we were okay and put us on his TV programmes and things. We did the old grey whistle test. Chris Lee, who has a long and enduring relationship with the blues, wrote a jazz column in the Evening News at that time. It went for several years, and he'd become a friend of mine by then. but he brought it to my attention in this column that James Booker, who a name which didn't mean a lot to many people but meant a lot to me, was in the country, and no promoter had taken up the gauntlet to put him on in the north of England. Well, I just discovered Booker in the previous 6 months or so. I had a fanatical and enduring interest in New Orleans rhythm and blues, which came about largely through my interest and involvement with Dr. John.
They call me Dr. John, known as the Night Tripper. Got my satchel of gris in my hand.
Dr. John was a very good source of knowledge on this subject. Apart from the music, which I'd always loved, Dr. John had made it clear that Booker was a very, very important figure, and I'd researched and found little bits of Booker on other people's records, etc. Joe Boyd, the record producer, had just recorded Booker for Ireland, a solo piano LP, which I'd got, and it was absolutely phenomenal. When I met Dr. John properly for the first time shortly after this, one of the first things I said was that I'd just played with Booker, and I mentioned this Ireland album, and Mac hadn't got the album. He didn't know it existed. It was only a matter of weeks before that it had come out. And now I was so taken with this record that I knew every track, and I listed the tracks for him, and Mac spent a whole evening at Graham Bond's wife, Diane Stewart's house, playing every single track and asking me, until he got it right, if Booker played it in this style. He knew exactly the style that Booker would play each tune, and was, of course, able to do it. And so he played the album for me without ever hearing it. I went out in the morning and bought him the album, you know, took it back to him. It's a very complex and involved, highly musical approach. It's not self-consciously musical, but there's so much technique involved in what Booker does. Almost impossible to emulate. John Cleary's pretty good at it. The first thing that occurred to me when I heard his playing on that Ireland album was that link, that rhapsodic element, which Dr. John wasn't doing too much of at that time, but has in recent, last 20 years, done more and more of that florid, decorative thing which Jerry Earl Morton did so well. Now, Booker was obviously aware of that style. There's so much of that in... he's just an all-pervading spirit in New Orleans. Everything goes back to long hair. The Latin rhythms and strange syncopations and whatnot.
You had left word with the lady upstairs to tell me that you didn't live down on.
Charles was a big influence on Booker. And Fats Domino, and the lesser known New Orleans pianists like Toots Washington. I knew that he was a big friend of Little Richard's. I knew that he played on many of the New Orleans sessions with Alan Toussaint, Huey Smith. I was aware of the fact that in New Orleans he was, hailed as absolutely the best piano player. Difficult to handle, sometimes a troubled soul, but the king of the keyboard. They called him the Bark of Rock and Roll. To rock and roll and rhythm and blues and New Orleans R&B and at the time pop music, he was playing organ on Aretha Franklin sessions, etc., was well known to me and to people in the business, but he wasn't a household name even to the aficionado. Booker had a whole other life as an organ player who could play all the four or five different parts of a piece of Bach music perfectly, you know, a superhuman musician really, who everybody who heard were absolutely astounded by. It's difficult when you're a creative force of that nature, like a Charlie Parker or a Sidney Bechet or a Louis Armstrong. How much can you take of that? But you know, how much can people take from that and use? It's not really possible. You can only create an impression of it, can't you? I'm sure there are pianists that I don't know about who have taken a lot from Booker, but his playing is so idiosyncratic and personal that it may be very difficult, you know. I mean, how many people play like Thelonious Monk? Only two I can think of, and one of them plays like Booker as well, Harry Connick. Teens even. Harry Connick's father was the district attorney in New Orleans, and he knew of Booker's reputation as a pianist, and knew that Harry obviously had talent, and asked him to tutor him, and Harry sings his praises very, very highly to this day, and in fact quite often sounds just like Booker. So I got it in my head to try and find a venue. I was even prepared to pay the fee myself because it wasn't extortionate. I think it was £180, which I had just about. So together I managed to convey this enthusiasm to my bandmate, Norman Beaker. I decided to approach various promoters and clubs around the area, gushing with enthusiasm, and got absolutely nowhere until everybody was very interested, but nobody actually would commit themselves until I spoke to the entertainments manager, who'd only been in the job for a few weeks, I think, at Bellevue was a zoo and entertainment complex in Manchester, which is very well known to northerners. It was a good day out. And I gushed with enthusiasm with all the details and facts I could draw up for about half an hour, at which point I was ready to eject myself. And he said, yes, we'll do it. and he gave us a budget as well for a bit of promotion, you know. So we continued with this evangelical fervour and leafleted everywhere we could possibly find, and all the media, etc. Booker arrived. We were all prepared. When I introduced myself to him, I think he was tired. He was polite, very civil. In no way kind of over the top, just slightly tired, I think, from his travelling, and wanted to lie down in the room. We hadn't booked a room for him, but the manager of the hotel did oblige here. And Booker disappeared for some time, during which my anxiety levels increased considerably. However, at the appointed hour, he came down. He actually came down in time to have a listen to my band, just to get some idea of what we were like, because it was suggested that we were going to share the stage at some point. He seemed to like it. In the meantime, several people began to talk to him, mainly about Gonzo, his Northern Soul hit. He did bring out his business card, which I regret not. He only had one, he didn't have a pack of them, he just had one. And it said James Carroll Booker, organist, pianist, musical arranger, vocalist, and founder member of the Lower Basin Street Drug Rehabilitation Society. Now, I mentioned this to Dr. John, and he laughed and said, yes, that's his card. And Dr. John had the card. He was so coveted, this piece of paper, that he carried it around with him. And he did say that, and he said, Dr. John said to me, I think he may be the only member. Probably 20 people at the most to turn up, and it was at the Lake Hotel. They didn't put it in one of the big ballrooms. It was a good idea because the Lake Hotel was absolutely packed. I just couldn't believe it. That I probably took more credit in my own mind than I should have done, because I think it was down to the absolute fervour with which we papered the whole of the North, you know, to inform them. Also, I didn't have a knowledge of how important James Booker's singles were to the Northern Soul crowd. In fact, I wasn't really too much aware of Northern Soul at that time, even though Roger Eagle, who was the founder of it, was a close friend of mine. I didn't pay a lot of attention to that. So they made up a part of the audience, you know. And that was it. The gig developed momentum, and on the day, there were more people than I could possibly have hoped for. He wasn't too well in the course of the gig, so, and other people had sort of taken him under the wing, and he seemed in the course of it, I'm familiar with a lot of Booker's work and Booker's concerts, and I hadn't heard him quite so animated previously. Maybe it was because he was in England, and the response was not lukewarm, it was ecstatic from the word go. Used to very sparsely attended blues gigs, and people tell me that they were at such and such a gig, and usually I can remember exactly who was there, and I never saw those people. And it was a financial success for Bellevue. After this particular gig, the management of Bellevue were so taken with it that they suggested that we might like to do it once a week. This was a very nice offer, which actually we did take them up on, but it was I could immediately see the difficulty in getting a blues legend every week to play in Manchester. We more or less managed it for about 6 months. Eddie Guitar Burns, Dr. Ross, of course, British people like Alexis Corner, who became a really good friend. Cousin Joe from New Orleans, Cousin Joe Pleasant, Louisiana Red, Willie Mabon, Jimmy Rogers, Snooky Pryor, Tommy Tucker. So I had the pleasure of playing High Heel Sneakers with Tommy Tucker. He didn't want to play it, but he agreed to do it because I told him that I just wanted to be able to tell people for the rest of my life I'd played High Heel Sneakers with Tommy Tucker. Sneaker, wear your big hat on your head. Know you're gonna be your heart. I'm pretty sure you're gonna knock him dead.